My guest today, Hassan Hafida, is currently in the doctoral program at the University of Leeds in the British Midlands, specializing in comparative politics of the Middle East and a focus on civil society networks and sectarianism in the Gulf states. Reading his comments of the public execution by the Saudis of Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr, along with 46 others by the Saudi monarchy, I phoned him in Leeds and asked him to speak today on the issues involved in this grotesque public spectacle. Welcome, Hassan Fida, to Takes on the World.
Thank you very much for having me.
When you wrote this mass beheading, which most of the American media did not refer to as the beheadings, they called it executions, because they didn't want to associate it with ISIS. You wrote that the executions of the prominent Shia sheikh and human rights activist in the Saudi Arabia was not a miscalculation on the Saudis' part, as some analysts would like to believe. You said the timing of the execution itself, alongside al-Qaeda suspects, were telling signs that this was a premeditated move and to send out a clear message to both regional and international actors alike. What was that message?
Well, as I noted, Jeffrey, in the article itself, one primarily being that as Western media is generally starting to catch on or starting to gain more attention on human rights situation more broadly, not only in Saudi Arabia, but more broadly within the Gulf, it actually, funnily enough, it actually took the imprisonment of a British man who was caught with wine or alcohol in his boot when he was travelling through Saudi Arabia, and I think he received a couple of hundred lashes or something, or he was about to receive a couple of hundred lashes. This was really the starting point where Western media actually, you know, or mainstream Western media at least, started to pick up on the human rights issues within Saudi Arabia. But coming back specifically to the Sheikh Nimr case, which surprisingly did gain quite a bit of traction, you find that one primarily being, as I noted, any form of dissent, if you like, be it passive or violent resistance, won't be tolerated by the kingdom whatsoever. And that's primarily because the Saudi kingdom at this point in time, from a social, political, and economic perspective, is starting to look desperate, both at home and abroad itself. And these were really, and this execution at this time as well, at such a volatile time, is really Saudi Arabia acting rash. And you can tell this was really this was telling signs that they were, you know, dismayed, if you like, by actions from the Obama administration, particularly with the agreement last year on the P5+1 nuclear deal. Even Secretary John Kerry has spoken about the lifting of sanctions on Iran, for instance, could be removed at any time. This should supposedly unlock some $100 billion of frozen assets, of frozen Iranian assets. And so I think the Saudis are generally feeling quite aggrieved that the Western powers, if you like, have basically overlooked the Saudis' reservations, if you like. And even one of the Saudi princes until today keeps saying, for instance, that we don't necessarily oppose an Iran deal, but we'd rather it was, you know, a P5+2, for instance, where, you know, the Saudis or Saudi Arabia representing the GCC, which is the Gulf Cooperation Council, could also be incorporated into this supposed nuclear deal. So there's also the comment, for instance, that there's the argument that it's a two-way street, that Saudi Arabia that it could be Iran that's trying to provoke Saudi Arabia into direct confrontation. But there are several factors, and if you look at the evidence on the ground, that it's actually vice versa. You know, this execution is just one of several signs that it's actually Saudi Arabia in particular that are seeking confrontation with Iran in order to give them the ideal pretext in order to cut diplomatic relations. So this execution of Sheikh Nimr was certainly politically motivated.
Well, it's interesting, after the response in which some Iranians sacked at least part of the Saudi embassy in Tehran, you saw all the Saudi allies rallying to its cause. It was interesting to see Sudan, whose government is constantly being condemned by Washington and by the West, among the supporters of the Saudis breaking off relations. And there were no comments about how Sudan's government is viewed in the West in other circumstances.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, we can talk about Sudan, or we can talk about other, you know, other regional allies of Saudi Arabia. You find a similar case, for instance, with this newly formed 34-state coalition that Saudi Arabia set up as well. So these are a coalition of states, Islamic states, supposedly, that are formed against a coalition against extremism, if you like. But really, it should be referred to, or should be phrased as a sectarian coalition, essentially, because when you actually look at the list of the countries, what's more interesting, rather, is the Muslim-majority countries that have been excluded from the coalition. So we find that Iraq, Iran, Syria, Oman, interestingly, is a member of the GCC as well. They were excluded. All these countries happen to not be Sunni-led governments or Sunni-led monarchies, if you like. And even we found in the context of Pakistan, for instance, Pakistan have just recently withdrawn or decided to withdraw from this coalition, as well as the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen, which we'll get onto later on as well, basically because Islamabad or Pakistan's parliament started to have reservations about deploying their own army to help out Saudi Arabia's incursion within Saudi Arabia, requested that only soldiers of Sunni identity or of a Sunni background were to be recruited, and not from any other identities or sects. So that's particularly interesting. We found, as you noted in the Sudanese case, we found other African nations that have just been signed up or just complied with this. Namely because some of these states are essentially bankrupt. You've got states like Togo, for instance, which is actually a Christian-majority country, Djibouti. These states are virtually bankrupt. Even in North Africa, you've got Egypt, which regularly receives, which is basically living off aid packages at the moment from the Saudis or the United Arab Emirates. So, I mean, these states really, I wouldn't look too much into it in terms of the ideological motivations, if you like. These states, in terms of their policies, if you like, or their foreign policies, are all pretty much dependent on where the money comes from, essentially.
It's interesting to watch the change of Saudi foreign policy over the years. During the Cold War, it was a major, important ally of the United States, financing the Mujahideen in Afghanistan against the Russians, financing the Contras in Nicaragua. It was major purchaser of U.S. weapons, but wasn't using them and kind of chose to remain in the shadows. And the first time we saw, at least I saw, some aggressive move when the Saudis moved into Bahrain with tanks to suppress the uprising in Bahrain. And, of course, many of these soldiers, I believe most of the soldiers in the Saudi military, are mercenaries, are not Saudis at all.
Yep. True. Well, just noted on that. It's the same, like I touched on with this coalition. Now, you find with not just Saudi Arabia, but the all of the GCC states, their armed forces are primarily made up of what are essentially foreign mercenaries. And it's interesting you picked up on Bahrain, for instance. Bahrain, until today, is currently occupied still by Saudi Arabia's army. They saw their neighbours, essentially the ruling regime in Bahrain, the Al Khalifa family, were essentially going to be overthrown during the height of the 2011 Arab uprisings. They had to come in. I think it was around 1,000 or 1,500 troops, along with 500 Emirati or troops from the UAE. And so you find that even in Bahrain, for instance, and Saudi Arabia for that matter, the security forces, so both the police and the armed forces, not only primarily made up of these foreign mercenaries who become naturalized, who are basically gained citizenship at the expense of the indigenous population, both in Bahrain and Saudi Arabia, who have their citizenship revoked. These are generally people who are human rights activists or working for NGOs, which are deemed illegal in both countries. Again, you know, the utilization of sectarian policies, which have been around, which predate even not only 2003 but 1979, for instance, where, you know, the conventional wisdom is, if you like, that, you know, sectarian identities or sectarian tensions only came to fruition following Iran's revolution in 1979. But we find in the Gulf, for instance, prior to this, the indigenous Shia population, which comes back to the case of Sheikh Nimr in what he was advocating in the Gulf, that not only has there been a disenfranchisement of the Shia populations in the Arabian Peninsula, but also they've been a securitized population, so they've always been treated as fifth columnists, if you like, or, you know, their loyalties are external to the country, or they don't have any loyalty to the country, so therefore they should be viewed as suspicion. And so this has been actualized in policies in both Saudi and Bahraini policy making for a number of decades now, and you find with the police forces and the armed forces within both countries, Shias are not allowed to actually be employed. This is just one of the several ways in which those populations there are securitized and treated with suspicion, always viewed as suspicion. And so this comes back to one of the quotes, even in Sheikh Nimr's sermons, that rose a few alarm bells with the Saudi authorities, where, you know, he says himself, I lived in Saudi Arabia for over half a century now. And he says, everywhere you look, everywhere you go within this country, you're treated with suspicion. You know, even the walls, you fear them, for instance, in fear that you might be interrogated or questioned by someone. So this, you know, and so this, this reverberated a lot with the Shia community, both in Saudi Arabia and Bahrain, where they felt, you know, they've essentially been treated as fifth columnists who have some external loyalties. And the problem you have now, especially, is that Shia identity, if you like, is constantly being conflated with Iran. So anybody who talks about human rights, even if they themselves don't come from a Shia background, so for instance in Bahrain, you have political rights activists who come from Sunni backgrounds, but they're still regarded as agents of Iran for some reason, because they are working or cooperating in solidarity with disenfranchised Shias. So when we're looking back at you know, this protracted sectarian identities and sectarianized politics, if you like, you find that it's actually more a one-way street coming out of these Gulf states. Because their existence and the survival of these autocracies is actually dependent on sectarian politics.
And this time, support from the Saudis. It's interesting, and maybe you could comment on the fact that Saudi aggression, whether it was in Bahrain and now much more seriously in Yemen, seems to get, with the not only selling weapons to the U.S. has not only sold the weapons to the Saudis that they're using in Yemen, but they're also, U.S. is also providing intelligence and selecting targets for the Saudis. And yet there's a total pass, a waiver on criticizing Saudi Arabia's behavior on the part of the U.S. political class, and pretty much the same in Britain, where the Saudis have tremendous influence. Perhaps you could talk about that.
Absolutely, yeah. So as you've rightfully pointed out, and this comes back to a larger problem with how entangled this problem of Western impunity is, and how it affords, and how Western impunity is afforded towards its regional allies. And this has become a great stumbling block and an impediment to so many issues within Middle Eastern societies, be it state repression, be it counter-extremism, for instance. You know, there's a lot of talk and a lot of hysteria around how to combat and how to deal with extremism. But I'll come to that shortly afterwards. But just touching specifically on your point with Yemen, It's important to know that Saudi Arabia doesn't just abuse human rights or carries out human rights violations at home. So since March of last year, there was a Saudi-led coalition that carried out a bombing campaign against the Houthis, or who's known as Ansar Allah, in Yemen. But these have included indiscriminate attacks, mainly towards civilians, including women and children, and which have been deemed as war crimes by some international human rights bodies. And what's interesting and what's particularly alarming is we find the use of internationally illegal or banned cluster munition bombs that have been used in civilian populated areas. What's particularly unfortunate and alarming about this is that these were US made and they've been sold by America and Britain. You find also the Saudi-led coalition's it's imposed a naval and an air blockade on Yemen's 23 million population, and this has contributed to alarming malnutrition levels, according to the UN, for instance. So we hear a lot of talk, for instance, a lot of reporting about the siege of Madaya in Syria now, where certain towns have been besieged, and there's issues of malnourishment and children, women, civilians not being fed. But Yemen's been going through this for almost 2 years now, and in the poorest country in the Middle East, might I add, and which was already suffering, you know, from dire humanitarian crisis even prior to the escalation of this conflict. And so this conflict has only exacerbated those problems. But what's particularly interesting is how that links back to international powers again. And so you find that Saudi Arabia's recent membership, or their voting in as the chairman or the head of the UN Human Rights Council, some analysts in the West had hoped, or the political class, maybe classes in both the US and UK had hoped, that this may end up leading to some improvements in their human rights records, especially abroad. But instead, what the Saudis have done, because many people have been asking, well, you know, Saudi Arabia got voted into this the Human Rights Council, but what are its actual powers? Well, the particular reason for it, and UK and US both gave its vote to Saudi Arabia, it's basically used its position at the UN to prevent an international inquiry into the laws of war violation that they've committed in Yemen. So just the fact that they won't allow an inquiry into potential war crimes that have taken place in Yemen is particularly telling in itself, and it's quite alarming how easily bought, essentially, the Western political classes are. But now, I think, interestingly, especially in continental Europe, places like Germany and Sweden, Holland, for instance, politicians and political parties have started to become increasingly disillusioned with their country's disengagement with Saudi Arabia. I think this week, for instance, we found there was a number of political parties in the Netherlands, for instance, that have called for a cancellation of all arms deals to Saudi Arabia. Even German intelligence, BND, for instance, had leaked a memo. There was a memo that was leaked by the German intelligence who had been speaking about how basically Saudi Arabia has essentially been provoking or been longing or yearning in recent years confrontation and provoking conflict, be it in Syria or in Yemen. Particularly when it comes to the, like as I mentioned, Western political classes, it's becoming increasingly worrying how easily bought Western politicians can be.
My guest is Hassan Hafida. We were speaking about Saudi Arabia and what it is doing and in the Middle East. One other aspect, they seem to have a lot of success with Western media. The London Economist just gave a five-hour interview with Mohammed bin Salman, the son of the king, and NPR, National Public Radio, here yesterday. Deborah Amos, a woman reporter there, a longtime veteran of Middle East reporting, was so enamored of being allowed into Saudi Arabia to do an interview that she totally, she wrote, totally neglects to mention Yemen at all. And we don't hear anything or read anything, hardly anything, about what's going on in Yemen. And the president, who shed a tear over the massacre at Sandy Hook, with the school shooting, has not managed to shed a tear for what's been happening in Yemen or even mentioning it himself. Is there something, what I've seen in the British press, there is, British press tends to be more independent in the U.S. press. Are there criticisms of Saudi Arabia and the relation that the Saudis have with the British economy in England?
I think, well, perhaps in the British context at least, it's the situation starting to become a little bit complicated, because what you find is, where you'd maybe perhaps before see both government and at least state sympathetic media, if you like, or mainstream, or commonly referred to as mainstream media, towing the same line, we're starting to see British papers, British news generally take a more, at times a conflicting line, or at least a suspicious line on the British government's handling of its foreign policy in the Middle East more broadly. I mean, a few weeks ago, it was a few months ago now, for instance, the BBC, out of the blue, ran a one-hour documentary on one of their late-night news programs on the war in Yemen, for instance, and generally laid the blame at the Saudi-led coalition, rightly so, to be honest. But the problem we have is that both the British government's response and the US's response is really it almost seems that they can't take an independent line of thinking, or they can't step outside of the their own investments, and if you like the because of Western and Gulf states' relationships are so entangled. There's so much, you know, there's so much invested both socio-politically and economically. So, you know, David Cameron talks about how Saudi Arabia are an important ally for us because we share important intelligence, or vital intelligence, that keeps our country safe, for instance. But at the same time, you find this is somewhat of a paradox, because the state institutions within Saudi Arabia, particularly in Saudi Arabia and Qatar, whose state-sponsored faith is Salafism or Wahhabism, which is an ultra-conservative, arguably a ultra-conservative brand of Sunni Islam, they essentially told the same line as ISIS and Al-Qaeda. And more worrying, as what is essentially public knowledge now, especially in the Syrian context, you find that it's unfortunately Western allies, be it NATO member Turkey, Saudi Arabia and Qatar, that have basically proliferated and facilitated extremist movements in the form of the Jaish al-Fatah coalition, which comprises of hardline Islamist groups such as Farah al-Sham, and even including, ironically enough, Al-Qaeda's affiliate in Syria, Jabhat al-Nusra, which gets minimal or zero coverage, media coverage, especially in America, but in Britain as well. But it comes back to the wider problem, like you mentioned, with the NPR example, Deborah Amos. It's hard, or it's rarely talked about in a sensible way, this issue, looking at the long-term causes of radicalization and how to counter the subsequent extremism. Because of Saudi Arabia and these Gulf states more broadly just continue to hire a spree of US lobbyists and PR experts. Funnily enough, they also funded in huge NGOs, influential NGOs. So, for instance, the Clinton Foundation. I find it rather ironic sometimes when Hillary Clinton is talking about, you know, exporting human rights values, human rights principles, exporting democracy, for instance, when her organization is in cahoots with one of the worst human rights abusing regimes in the world. And so you find this is really this is the telling sign, if you like, of Western foreign policy for quite a while now. So when news of the execution of Sheikh Nimr came out, for instance, of course Western powers couldn't come out and condone it. But what you generally find is this very almost apathetic or indifferent. It's telling. It's an indifferent stance by both the FCO, the Foreign and Commonwealth Office here in the UK, and the State Department in America. You get this rather generic statement where they say, "Oh, we have expressed concerns." They're always expressing concern or expressing disappointment, for instance, which really isn't the word that you should be using, or that, you know, they'll meekly request that their partners in the Gulf revise their position on executions or the death penalty, for instance. And again, it's rather telling that they're indifferent to it when they're essentially being blinded by both money and, because more importantly, because the Gulf states essentially act as a bulwark towards what they deem, or what the West deems, as Iranian expansionism or Iranian influence. I'm still yet to find out what Iranian expansionism particularly is, given that most of it's contrived by the paranoia of policymakers in Riyadh and Doha, but and in Washington for that matter.
You know, we keep getting that question
about
Iran expansionism, but as I say, they don't give examples of it because Iran is not waging war in any of the, they are assisting Syria as in Hezbollah, but in terms of geographic expansion and waging war in other countries, they're not doing that. But one of the most, obviously, in the United States, the Saudis provided a jobs program for American workers, and without the Saudis and Kuwait, but mostly the Saudis, purchasing U.S. weaponry, particularly our fighter jets, factories would close. And so they don't have to buy politicians directly, but our arms industry has factories in almost every state in the union. So member of Congress is close to, has an interest, a vested interest in keeping those factories open. So you don't hear any mention, any discussion on the Democratic side of the military-industrial complex or the size of it, or the weapons sales. And the Saudis are critical in that. And so I think that's one of the holes they have over both the U.S. and Britain, because they also buy from Britain.
Well, I actually watched a recent interview with the Canadian foreign minister as well, who actually made the exact same point, or at least the presenter asking the questions were, by saying that, you know, the new liberal, or what would be, I'm guessing, the equivalent to the Democratic Party in the US, had just come in with Justin Trudeau's administration. And they'd spoken about the $15 billion deal that the last government, so Stephen Harper's government, did with the Saudis. He was asked, for instance, would they retract or would they revise that arms deal? And the current government now said, no, we can't retract or revise, go back on deals or transactions or arms transactions that were done by the last government. But what they've supposedly promised is that we will carry out a more rigorous inspection next time we do any conduct any arms deals or transactions with governments we deem to be questionable when it comes to human rights. What's particularly ironic, I presume in the United States, but in the UK, the British administration, rather ironically, invests or sells arms to 13 countries on its own human rights abusers list. So, and the majority of those are in the Middle East. So when we come back to like coverage on Syria, on Libya, or the lack of coverage on Libya, at least anyway, you find that it's this impunity that's afforded to these governments to ultimately invest in state repression on their own civilian population, and in particular in the Gulf states, as I mentioned, have exported the ideological foundations, if you like, of extremist ideology. it's all a bit it's somewhat disingenuous for Western governments to really say that they're trying to tackle or they're trying to combat extremism.
Well, it's interesting.
Both at home and abroad. Yeah. Sorry, go on.
No, it's interesting when the United States, Obama encourages the Saudis and Qatar and Turkey to do more to combat ISIS. From this vantage point, it would seem that were it not for the Saudis, Qatar, and Turkey, there would not be an ISIS in Syria.
Precisely. Yeah, well, I mean, even, you know, we haven't even discussed, for instance, Turkey's facilitation of what would essentially be extremists in any other regard, within crossing the Syrian and Turkey border, both supplying arms, selling oil to ISIS, purchasing oil from ISIS. Sorry. What's interesting in within Turkey now, and you know, you're finding extremism there, suicide bombing attacks, as we found in Syriza last year. The Ankara bombing, the Istanbul bombing in a popular tourist destination just yesterday. We're finding across the Western world now, extremism is almost an inevitable. And like we find in the Middle East, it's becoming more and more ubiquitous, more and more pervasive, more and more on a regular basis. And the problem we have now, particularly in Turkey's context, is that Erdogan's trying to issue new powers in to become what he calls supposed more strongman leader. He wants to bring in executive powers, which essentially means, you know, eroding all the democratic functions and democratic mechanisms that Turkey have worked so hard on in the last two decades. These are quickly starting to erode. And so we find, you know, particularly a silencing of opposition media, of opposition human rights activists, party activists, the plight of the Kurdish population in Turkey, for instance. What's interesting is that President Erdogan himself had said that, you know, he's heard of these claims that his government has essentially mobilized or facilitated extremists. And so in one news release, he actually mentioned, you know, for those critics who argue this case, he asked them to bring out proof or, you know, some concrete or substantial evidence that Turkey is colluding with groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS. But what's ironic is that whenever a prominent Turkish journalist, which happened last year, when they do provide evidence, they end up being incarcerated for 30, 40-year sentences on grounds that it was treason or against the state, for instance. So that's somewhat ironic as well. And so this is an important point as well in the Gulf context. Even if there isn't visible or tangible evidence of the Saudi government or the any of the Gulf governments directly aiding and abetting these extremist groups, as I mentioned, they're still very much complicit, even in mobilizing groups like ISIS. For instance, they ISIS schools are known to use the same textbooks that Saudi schools use, for instance. It's a similar case as we saw in the 1980s, where we found, you know, as you touched on earlier, the Afghan Mujahideen battling the Soviets, both the US, both the CIA and Saudi Arabia were backing them in the 80s, and they'd basically essentially funded and built up these madrasas, or what are known as religious seminaries. And so now we find in the South Asian or the South Asian subcontinent, for instance, we find that extremism's become prevalent there. So every time you start to see extremism emerging on a regular basis, be it in the Middle East or on the Pakistan-Afghanistan border, now we're seeing in Western Central Africa, for instance, extremism's become more pervasive with groups like Boko Haram and Al-Shabaab. You always start to find that there is an investment or a pumping of petrodollar wealth, the money trail, if you like, that has spread to these areas. And now we're starting to see it. We're starting to see it in Western societies as well, both in continental Europe and in the US. And so this problem's only going to become bigger. And, you know, I think the reality of it is starting to dawn upon the majority of civilians and the general public in the West, But it seems that governments, Western governments, are still trying to backtrack and still trying to make this assumption that our biggest enemy, for instance, is Iran and Syria. Ironically, the only two states that the State Department has, that the US, sorry, has imposed sanctions on, based on human rights violations, which is, again, another quite contradictory policy, given that nearly every Middle Eastern state is an autocracy and carries out human rights violations. So, you know, the Western government's trying to pretend they've got some concern for human rights. Again, like I said, it's somewhat disingenuous.
And hypocritical.
To extremism. Yeah, precisely.
Hassan, I want to thank you so much for being our guest today. We've come to the end of the hour, a very enlightening hour. I know we're going to have to do it again because the situation there is not going to get any better in the nearest future. Hassan Hafida, thanks so much for being our guest today on Takes on the World.
Thank you very much for your time.
This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.